Function has become cost of entry, and that sucks for you. The simple universal truth is that in today's world of computerized production and globalized distribution, most products work even better than we expect them to. And if you do a little digging, you'll discover that many of the components that make up the many different products we purchase all come from the same factories, or are at least built based on the same technology and the same patents to begin with. From automobiles to laptops to microwave ovens, one product's functionality is similar or identical to its competition's because its origins and components are as well. CDs moved music from the analog to the digital environment. With the introduction of this new technology, all the problems associated with old, analog record players disappeared, and pops, scratches, and hiss were all things of the past. Why? Because unlike analog recording, which loses its quality and resolution with each pass, digital recording, for example, duplicating a CD, is a lossless procedure. In other words, a digital reproduction is actually a clone and not a copy of the original, because it includes every bit of its parent's data. And while there may be many different recording formats, including WAV, AIF, MP3, and MP4 files, the information recorded in all of them is always digital, so reproduction imposes no degradation or information penalty. Thanks to digital technology, then, the high-quality reproduction of music has become both generic and ubiquitous. While we're talking about home entertainment, think about televisions for a moment. If you are old enough to remember what televisions looked like before flat screens, you're probably thinking of a big box, angled in the back to fit the picture tube, and maybe even a set so old that it had dials on the front to change the channels and adjust the volume. Remember those dials? At some point, the little gears inside them would strip, and they wouldn't be able to grip the little peg in the middle that changed the channels. That happened often enough that it wasn't odd to visit a friend and see a small pair of pliers or a vice grip locked onto the little post where the dial used to be. How about remote controls? Remember those strange little boxes with the big buttons sticking out of them? Unlike today's remotes, which do virtually everything but toast your bread and make your coffee in the morning, the early ones were only good for changing the channel and raising and lowering the volume. But sooner or later they'd stop working too, and the only way to change the channel would be to get up off the couch and walk across the room to the actual TV set. Believe it or not, the three networks operating at the time would schedule new or less popular shows after blockbuster hits because they knew that lots of viewers were too lazy to get up and change the channel and would therefore watch a program they wouldn't ordinarily choose. Antennas, remember them, would also break, and then the TV would be incapable of picking up the broadcast at all. Stores like Radio Shack did a brisk business selling replacement antennas known as rabbit ears. Most of the time, though, people would just replace the snapped-off antenna with a wire clothes hanger bent in the same V-shape as the original. This workaround didn't usually work very well, but then the TV's resolution and picture quality weren't that good to begin with. Of course, the biggest problem with the old TVs was that eventually the picture tube would blow, and then the set would be completely worthless. Regardless of whether your dial dialed, your remote control controlled remotely, or your antenna had been replaced by a shirt hanger, once the tube blew, the old TV was a worthless piece of junk taking up space in your living room, and it was time to go out and buy a new set. But after many years of development, televisions finally evolved to a level where they didn't break anymore. And this caused a big problem for television manufacturers, because the TV market was mature, and because most everyone who wanted a television already had one, there was simply no reason for anyone to purchase a new set. The television industry overcame customers' purchase reluctance with technological innovation. TVs got bigger and bigger, screens got brighter and clearer, and the sound got better and better, incentivizing consumers to go out and buy new sets. Cable-ready and web-enabled boxes, DVRs, high-def, and smart TVs were just a few of the many leaps in the technological race that gave consumers and retailers an entirely new way of looking at, thinking about, and purchasing televisions. Thanks to flat-screen technology, consumers were able to buy larger and larger sets and mount them on their walls, finally making high-quality home theaters possible even for budget-conscious buyers. A few years after flat screens became ubiquitous, my wife and I redid our house. While we were replacing the drywall in our family room and bedrooms, we decided to run the wires so that we too could install flat screen sets. And that meant that our old TVs, a big Sony Trinitron and an even larger JVC, had to go. I got up on a chair and pulled the TV's cartons out of our storage space and repackaged the sets in their original boxes, complete with the styrofoam packing material and their original manuals in the little bags they came in. Believe it or not, I still had the little batteries for the remote controls lying in their little plastic bags, secured with their own tiny little staples. But what was I going to do with these two old but perfectly preserved televisions? I offered them to the guy who mows our lawn, but he didn't want them. I offered them to the mechanic who keeps my old car running. He didn't want them either. I addressed an email to everybody, the distribution list for all the people who work in my company, offering the two televisions on a first-come, first-served basis to whoever wanted them. No one even responded. Because we were doing all this work around our house, we had collected bags of things we didn't want or need anymore. Clothes that had been out of style for years, equipment for sports our kids didn't play anymore, chipped pottery, broken records, and all the other things that had filled our drawers and closets for years and years. I loaded them all into boxes and slid them into the back of my wife's SUV. Then I hitched on the bicycle rack and went looking for my kids' old bikes. I found them leaning against the chain-link fence over by the garbage cans, rusty old bicycles that my kids had jumped off of one day and left outside to weather the elements. It was no surprise that they'd never been stolen. Who would have wanted them? I hoisted the bikes up onto the rack and drove to the nearest Goodwill center to unload my stash. The woman manning the Goodwill happily showed me where to park the rusty bikes and pointed to the dolly she wanted me to use to move the cartons to the corner of the back room. It wasn't until I reached into the car to pull out the TV boxes that she protested. "No, sir, not those. We don't take old TVs." I was surprised at her outburst, but quickly assumed it was because the woman didn't know my TVs were in perfect condition. After all, Goodwill probably didn't want to be the collection point for piles of broken televisions that they would just have to throw away after their donors had left. "Oh, don't worry," I assured her. "These TVs work perfectly. Look, I even have the manuals and the remote controls. If you have an outlet somewhere, I'll plug them in and show you." "Sir," she answered, clearly annoyed, "we don't want your old TVs." "But they're perfect," I protested. "Someone will want them. They're great TVs." "Sir," she repeated, more annoyed this time, "no one wants them. Even poor people have flat screens." How I finally got rid of those old TVs doesn't really matter, but what I learned matters a lot. My experience with those perfectly good televisions opened my eyes to a new idea. In a society and time where most everything works, function has become cost of entry. Consumers, even those with limited means who shopped at Goodwill to save money, weren't just choosing products for what they could accomplish. They were choosing them for what they said about the purchaser. Perfectly good televisions weren't good enough. People needed something more. If all products and services worked equally well, or at least appear to, then that very functionality becomes an expected commodity. What used to be the paramount feature of a product, how well it worked, is no longer an important part of a consumer's consideration set, because they can find the same quality anywhere. Instead, a new mantra has arisen that explains how and why consumers buy in today's hyper-efficient, hyper-connected society. People don't choose what you do. They choose who you are. In other words, when all products are similarly functional and acceptable, it's the way a product makes you feel, not the way it works, that matters. This means that whether or not Steph's book was better than mine was ultimately irrelevant. For whatever reason, his celebrity, remember, he was the design industry's it boy that year, his good looks, his charm, his history of groundbreaking work, his reputation, his list of industry awards, the attendees at the design conference felt better about themselves because they had a little piece of Steph. Carrying his signed book under their arms made them feel good, and made them feel good about themselves. They had touched the celebrity fire and lived to tell about it. Because the attendees at the design conference had never heard of me or my company, my book was just a book, another functional device for them to read and store on their bookshelves. But Steph's book was so much more than a book, because of all the good feelings that came along with it. Like hanging a new flat-screen television on the wall, displaying Steph's book on their coffee tables showed they had a keepsake, a souvenir of their experience to savor later.